So this is Kate Magruder. I'm at the Grace Hudson Museum. It's June 1st. These are oral interviews for the Promise of Paradise Oral History Project.
My name is Sheila Rogers.
Where and when were you born?
I was born in Windsor, Ontario, in the Great Lakes region, and it was in 1942.
Why and when did you come to Mendocino County?
I came to Mendocino County in 1972 out of the Bay Area. I had previously lived in Ecuador as a Peace Corps volunteer and in New York and in Chicago. And in Chicago, I had met a man who had also been a Peace Corps volunteer in Ecuador. And we ended up deciding that we wanted to try California. We came to Mendocino County because there was another Peace Corps volunteer who had been in Ecuador at the same time we were, George Rao, and we came up to visit him and his wife Estella.
And what was going on in your life after the Peace Corps? What made you think you wanted to come to some out of the way place like Mendocino County?
I may or may not known that I wanted to come to an out-of-the-way place when I came to Mendocino County. My childhood really was about a lot of open space, being in the Great Lakes region, and our vacations were always in wild places, and I grew up with backyard gardens. Everybody had backyard gardens, and so that was a way of life for me. In the Peace Corps, it was very different, and I became used to living without a lot of conveniences, like a telephone in my own house or my own car, any of those things. So I was ready for something simpler. And at the time that I came up here, I was with a man named Bill. We had decided that we wanted to leave the Bay Area. It was just too busy for us. It was too urban. And he had been raised in Chicago. We both decided that we were going to move to either New Mexico or Oregon. And Oregon was closer, and we had this one friend who lived here already, who we had been visiting previously in previous months. So we were on our way to Oregon, actually. We had been camping out in Marin County. And Bill said, why don't we just stop in, Ukiah and, see what that is. So we went to the state hospital. By noon, he walked in there just to see if there were any jobs. And he walked out. I just sat in the car. He walked out and he said, well, there's sort of a volunteer kind of job. I'll get paid a little bit, but I think I want to take it. So it was like 1:30 in the afternoon by then. So we called George and we said, George, Bill got this job today, and we're thinking of looking for a place to live. How do you do that around here? And George said, well, look in the Daily Journal for rentals. There was a rental of a cottage behind a house on Road I in Redwood Valley. And we moved in that evening. So it was, I can't even say it was deliberate that we moved here on purpose, but it made sense. It seemed like, well, this might be a good place to be. It sounds pretty easy. It seems pretty easy to settle in one day. So that's what we did.
What were your first impressions of the natural world here?
Well, it was very beautiful, for one thing, the surrounding hills and all. And it was springtime when we came here, so the wildflowers were starting to come out. We could walk places, we could find swimming holes easily, we could pick berries that summer, right along the roadway. It just seemed like such a wonderful, easy, simple place. We both had undergraduate degrees. We had been doing sort of casual jobs, I think I would say. In those days, I wasn't interested in being a professional anything. I was just living.
How was that you were just interested in living and that you weren't? That was a time when it seemed like, one was supposed to grow up and get a job and, make a life and join the real world.
While I was in the Peace Corps, the Vietnam War really got working itself up. And when I came home, and lived in Chicago particularly, we regularly marched. And so that had sort of changed everything. I mean, it was, hippies showed up while I was in Ecuador. I didn't know what they were. And I kind of took it on. And for a while it was, we lived off savings. We lived off, like, really, I mean, the first summer I was here, I took a job as a cook for the Division of Forestry during the fire season. That's ironic now that we've just lived through the Redwood Valley fire. But I was working out of the Hopland Station and earning enough money. You didn't need a lot of money in those days. I mean, that little cottage was probably $75 a month or something. And we planted vegetables that summer. And, you know, so it was easy to live very simply and just have friends and, you know, just do things, read books, take walks. You know, we traveled a bit in the Western region to visit other friends. And neither one of us was planning to have children. Little did we know that we weren't going to be ending up staying together that much longer. But, you know, it was very simple living.
This is a question you don't need to answer, but I wonder if mind-expanding experiences had anything to do with your choice of living that kind of a life.
When we were in Chicago, we being this guy Bill and I, his siblings were all smoking marijuana and trying to get us to smoke it. And they would hand us stuff and say, this is really good. And then, you know, 3 weeks later, they say, what'd you think? And we go, oh, we haven't tried it. And they say, give it back, you know. So we weren't really getting into it. Subsequently, he did. I tried smoking and it didn't work for me, but along came peyote and along came other things like psilocybin and mushrooms, and we did use those and we did enjoy them, and most of our friends did too. It wasn't a constant thing, but it was an exciting experience. I mean, I remember some of the things that happened. I remember that it was just very relaxing for one thing, and like just take it as it comes, you know. And I've never been too interested in earning a lot of money or too interested in having a very busy professional life. I always thought it was more important to be able to, you know, look around and enjoy the night skies and enjoy the clouds and enjoy the new birds that season and everything. So, you know, I grew up with those kinds of values.
When you first came here, did you have a sense of being an outsider? Were there, do you remember any encounters with community members that stand out to you?
I remember thinking that I probably wouldn't have any friends for at least a year, because at first we didn't know that many people that were kind of the mindset that we were. And it was a very traditional community, it seemed, and it was a little bit hard to break in, we thought. But subsequently, Bill moved, his job moved to Trinity School, and he started meeting like-minded people, and there were baseball teams. You know, the guys were on teams, and the women showed up for the games, and those women are some of my best friends to this day. So I think it was that first summer when, you know, I got introduced to people of like mind, but we were then a core group and we did not really interact with the rest of the community. I think that's really true. It's also really true that there wasn't that much else to do around here. So, I mean, I remember being entertained by going to the Rexall drugstore, you know, and just like cruising the shelves. I mean, there was really nothing to do. There was no UPT, there was no live music, at least that we knew about. So, you know, and we were living out there in Redwood Valley and then on the Hopland Grade, which was even more remote. And we were content to just be ourselves and have those friends. So we did not mingle with the people who had been here for a long time.
And when did that relationship change and why? Your relationship with Bill, your initial relationship?
That relationship changed pretty quickly. We were here in the spring of 72. By 73, it was really not working that well. We had a regard for each other, but that was not meant to be. And he became interested in somebody else that he had met here in town. And so that really kind of did it. You know, he really wanted to move in that direction. And at first I was sort of like, well, what am I going to do here now? You know, but I went away for 1 year and kept in touch with my friends who were here. And when I came back, one of those friends had bought a house and I could move in. And so I became my own person living in Ukiah at that point.
What was your first job in Ukiah?
Well, my first job was the job as the cook in the Hopland Station. And then actually when I came back, being gone for the whole year of 1974, moved into the house in Ukiah, and one of my very good friends who was married to another one of my very good friends said, you know, there's this new health food store and you ought to go there and get a job. And because he, you know, he knew I liked to cook, and he knew I knew about food and I was interested in food. And so he sent me over to the corner store. So I had a job at the corner store beginning in the spring of 75. And that owner was building something that hadn't previously been here. And that was a really interesting place to work. I worked there for just a few months, and there was a small counter for sandwiches and stuff like that. But toward the fall, I wanted to go back to New England, where I had had a job the previous fall, you know, working in the tourism industry, and so did one of my girlfriends. So I said, "Well, Rick, I'm gonna leave. I'll be back. I don't know when." And he said, "Okay, fine." And it was like, "Whatever, you know. Apparently, you're making your own choices." And I came back about 7 months later. On March 1st, I think of 76, I walked into the store. He had subsequently hired a man named Steve Baird to run this cafe and grow the cafe within the store. And so he said to Steve, "Well, this is Sheila, and she used to work here, and she works here again." Steve, as you know, is my husband. So that job also led to, you know, the love of my life.
Well, before Steve, or before you really knew he was the love of your life, what were relationships like for you? What was the dynamics of relationships, and were they different from the relationships that you had known as you'd grown up or that you watched as a young person?
I was raised in a time when, you know, you grew up and you got married and you had children and that was it. And I was maybe one of two of my graduating high school class, which was small. It was a small class, like less than 100, but who hadn't done that, had gone in the Peace Corps instead, and, you know, and lived in New York City. And I hadn't had any important relationships, but when I came out here, there was much more of an opportunity to just have quick little romances. That happened a number of times. Nothing serious, but just fun and, you know, flirtatious. And so actually I was enjoying that quite a bit, even when I met Steve. And for a while I didn't even think I wanted to, I mean, I didn't fall in love with him on the spot or anything, but I had had just, I was just playing. And that was very different from how I was raised.
What has been a highlight of your experience here in your life in Ukiah?
I think the pleasure of having, knowing a place that is a place where I belong. It's a place that I can leave and come back to, and everybody still knows who I am. It's small enough, maybe, that, I mean, people, sometimes I overhear conversations of other people say, oh, I haven't seen you for a while, and they say, yeah, I lived in on the Big Island for 10 years, you know. So there's been the ability to come back to this, but this is so much home for me. I can't even believe that I could have found a place that suits me so well, with such comfort. And whether I'm alone or with a partner, I feel good here. I mean, it's beautiful for one thing, but it's also a quality of friendships that I have a few friends from other parts of my life, other times of my life, but the friends that I have here are just, I mean, we just know each other so well, and it's so, so strong, and even when we don't see each other that often, there's something very strong about the quality of those friendships that has always brought me back. You know, I've left a few times for short periods of time to try something else, but I think that's it. I think it's the other people who moved here who I relate to.
How was it that you were able to work or initiate West Company, and how important was that in your life for shaping who you are?
My professional life had gone between retail merchandising, either my own shops or working with friends, or in the city, like in New York City, retail merchandising. In Chicago and in the Peace Corps, certainly in the Peace Corps, I will tell you that I worked primarily with women artisans who had products that they made, and at the time sat beside railroad stations where one train came by a day trying to sell their wares. And there was a project that I was associated with in the Peace Corps that was trying to help market those Ecuadorian craft products out of Ecuador. So I worked with that project. So I worked with women, and I worked with very low-income women. And you can imagine it was, you know, a society that was not used to women being the breadwinners. So I had that in me, understanding them and appreciating how much they appreciated opportunities to have another life besides their family life, to have something that they did and income coming from it. So when I went to Chicago, I also worked with low-income neighborhoods, not so much on merchandising, but on education and children's programs and alternative education. It was a community organization. And again, it was African American and Puerto Rican primarily, and it was low-income families. So I really had, and also in New York City, I had worked with the daycare programs and visited often single women, single mothers, who were trying to raise kids and have a job at the same time. So I became very appreciative of the plight of women. And it's not as if I was saying I have to do something about this. It's just that I kept getting those kinds of jobs. So when West Company was getting framed, I wasn't there at the very beginning where hundreds of women gathered to figure out something that would be this West Company. And I had just gone off to graduate school to do some training in international development, and I thought I was going to end up moving around the world. I had met Steve, and I really didn't want to leave the area. And so I was working for Real Goods. Having worked there before, I went back and I was working for Real Goods again. And I had a friend who kept calling me and saying, Sheila, there is this thing. It's called West Company. It is your perfect combination. It's about women's business, and it's about low income and helping people out of poverty. And those were my two things that I had been learning to integrate and cared about. And I kept saying, that's not what I want to do. I studied international development. And she would call me every once in a while, and she would say, you got to try this. It's, you're the right one for it. So since she wouldn't let up, I decided to just go ahead and do the interview and, apply and do the interview. And I can still see myself in that interview with a couple of people that I knew and a couple of people that I didn't know. And a couple of hours later, I got a call saying, we want to hire you. So I guess they had decided, too, that I was the right person. It wasn't natural. I mean, it was. There had been two co-executive directors or program directors. It was a program of the community center, Ukiah Community Center. So they weren't CEOs or, but they had been fired like within 2 weeks of having started. Big problem. And so the whole company had gone through several months of just holding it together to find the right person. And
how did that shape you, that job?
The job was to build an organization that would provide an alternative for women to gain some income, an alternative to low-wage jobs. I mean, and that's kind of what was available to a large extent. There weren't any good-paying jobs. And it was working with women, some of whom were educated and some of whom were great artists, but they weren't making it. And so my job was, I mean, we had a four-year grant from a private foundation to build this thing. And the design was already in play because the design was the application for the funding to do this. And so it involved, being able to help them write a business plan, being able to help them learn what marketing was, how to read their financials, how to do all of those things. So my job was to get the right people in place to teach them those things and to then be innovative, because West Company was one of several brand new idea companies. They weren't even called microenterprises at the time. They were called self-employment organizations, but there were a few that had popped up, one in Minneapolis and one in Chicago, and so there were a few like mothers, if you will, but then along came this secondary group, and West Company was part of that. One of the very exciting things was that our funders knew about helping us learn, helping us about learn from each other, the peer learning thing that could happen. So they brought us together on a regular basis and allowed us to run. We tried this. Have you ever tried that? Did that work for you? Lending programs, circle lending programs, kinds of innovations. And our funders, who were primarily private funders, really wanted us to innovate and really wanted us to come up with new models and find out what would work and what would work in a rural area versus what would work in an urban area. Well, West Company is a founder of the National Trade Organization for Microenterprise Development and one of the four founders of CAMEO, which is the California, Trade Association, because we were the pioneers. And so for me personally, it was so exciting because I love to travel. And I was meeting these really smart women who were trying new things and, women from all walks of life, too. That was the other thing. So it was, it was just powerful and wonderful and loving. And, we were all learning and, making our mark.
If you were going to look back at this time, is there an experience that's kind of emblematic for you about what the fact of the Back to the Land movement or that era of people coming here that encapsulates what that really meant?
I'm thinking about the fact that the corner store was the first natural food store, I think, here in Ukiah, and the customers for that store were Back to the Landers as well as the traditional people who lived here, bankers and other professionals who, because the owner was a person who had lived here for a couple of generations, probably his family, it was mixing those populations. In the same way, West Company, for instance, was mixing populations between people of means and lower income people. And so I think one of the things that I have seen, and I guess the other thing I want to say is being able to live here in a rural area where there is an opportunity, for instance, to know where your food came from and to even grow it yourself. Those are the kinds of things that I think are really important for the planet in general, of people getting to know people who are not exactly like them. In a smaller community, at least for me, it's much easier to do that and to see it. You know, when I lived in big cities, I didn't know my neighbors. I had friends who lived in other parts of the city, but I lived in apartments where I never even saw my neighbors for weeks at a time. We must have come in at different times or something, you know. But here, you can see what's going on. It's visible, and I think there's more mixing.
Speaking of the corner store, can you describe it to me? If you walked into the corner store as it was in 1975, what would you be seeing?
You'd be seeing bins of bulk foods, and you would be seeing baskets of organic produce and coolers with things like kefir and yogurt and some of the things that many of us probably hadn't had before. I know I had never had kefir. And you would be seeing, it was a cement floor. It wasn't a wooden floor like in the old days, you know, of those kinds of stores that I even remember from my childhood, those kinds of stores that had bulk bins in them. But it was colorful, and there was a lot of variety in there. And, you know, there were even grocery lines and stuff, and eventually there was a big cheese case and, sort of more gourmet foods and stuff like that. So it was exciting for somebody who loves food, you know, looking at it and using it and cooking it and growing it and all. It was, you know, a very pretty picture.
How important was it that there was a cafe there for people to come for lunch?
I think that was a good opportunity for a community place, if you will. You know, maybe even to this day, we could use more of those. Certainly in Redwood Valley, we could. Something that's open more often than just like the Grange in Redwood Valley, for instance. You know, a lot of things happen there, but it's closed a lot of the time. So the community store had the cafe that people came for lunch, but then they also were there in the store, and it was the same people who came. You know, it was like a core of people. You can count on most of them coming in two or three times a week, you know, and the cafe had like a lunch special that changed every day and a soup that changed every day. And yeah, it was an opportunity for people, and mostly it was people who were working in, you know, the downtown area that were coming over for lunch, so they weren't hanging out forever, but they were getting to see their friends and relax a little bit.
What was your sense of how many people who were counterculture types were coming into Ukiah in those early years in the 70s?
I know when I first came here, and like we even looked at property on Greenfield Ranch, and that I was more aware of it maybe in that day, that people were showing up for the first time here and buying land. Subsequently, I don't know, I guess I had my own core of friends, and so I wasn't paying that much attention, but to this day, I see many, many, many people who I know have been here as long as I have, and even though we didn't become fast friends, I know you were here when I got here too.
How is the fact that you came here in the early 70s, how has that shaped your life?
I have been here for more than half of my life. I came here when I was 30, and I'm 76 now. So most of my life has been here. So clearly it works, because I'm not the kind of person that would say, oh, well, I guess I'll just have to stay there because I don't know what else to do. I mean, I live here on purpose, and that's because it's a good place for me to be, you know, no matter at what age and what's going on, and all the many things that I've been able to do. I mean, even, even being a costumer for a local playhouse, imagine that. I never imagined myself getting to do costumes for a local playhouse. But, you know, the opportunities have been so rich and so easily stepped into on a level because of the people who are here, and we get to know each other and we kind of know what each other's specialties are, so that, you know, you can count on that person to do that thing, for instance, and that would be the right person to call since you need help with this. What could be better than that? I mean, that is real community.
And how do you think this movement and the fact that so many people came here and who came here has shaped the county in general?
I think it's helped the county to become more diverse in its thinking, even in its political thinking, in its, and this is certainly not total, but in its knowledge of other peoples and how they live and where they came from and what they're about, because there's a better chance to meet people, like I've already said. There's a better chance to observe people who are not exactly like I am and what they're doing. I mean, that's one thing, and that's really important, I guess, because I remember when I was first here and I didn't know anybody that was on any ballot, and that's because none of the people that I was getting to know were on any ballot, and so I just had to guess sometimes, you know. But now, I typically know many, if not most, of the people that are on a ballot, and many of them are people that didn't, they're not fifth generation. Some of them are, and that's good too, but I think it's really important to mix the two, because I think it's really important to bring the world in here as well as you know, go out into the world. I really like it that some of the children of my friends have gone out into the world and that they come back here. They have something new to bring in, and that's really important, because otherwise a community would become stagnant. So I think having, you know, influxes of new kinds of thinking is a good thing for a community.
How could these stories of who came here and why and what they did be relevant to the second generation of people who are here now?
I think storytelling is something that really, really works in general to bring history alive and to bring the knowledge of how another family lives. I mean, I remember as a child, and I think probably many children grew up thinking, this is it, this is how all the families are. And I remember going to like my girlfriend's family's house, and what they did together on Sunday afternoon was totally different than what my family did on Sunday afternoon. So I think it's real important for those kids that grew up here and know what life is like here to want to come back, because if they've experienced something outside of here and still treasure this, that's pretty neat. Like, I didn't go back to where I grew up, and that's also because my parents died young, so there was no place to go back to on a level, I suppose. But to have a place where you grew up and you still think it's a pretty neat place, that's wonderful.
Is there anything else you want to say?
I really appreciate the opportunity. I think this is important to have these kinds of stories be told, because it's also true, I guess, in the end, that sometimes we really don't know what somebody's about or has been about. And to hear, oh, that person did that, is really a lovely thing, too, to find out. You know, we think we know what we're seeing, but we're not necessarily knowing what we're seeing. There's more in there than that can be revealed.
We've been listening to a lightly edited interview with Sheila Rogers as part of Promise of Paradise, Back to the Land, Oral Histories of Mendocino County. This program airs on KZYX at 3:30 on Thursday afternoons. You can also catch shorter excerpts during the news hour on Thursday mornings at 7:45, 8:45, and 6 p.m. Promise of Paradise is supported by the National Endowment for the Humanities, California Humanities, the Arts Council of Mendocino County, the Judy Pruden Historical Preservation Fund of the Community Foundation of Mendocino County, the Mendocino Institute, and Grace Hudson Museum.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear.